readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. One of my favorite things this holiday season is reuniting with old friends. More joyous than opening presents is catching up with folks at holiday gatherings. So I thought, 'tis the season to reunite with old literary friends. Today we'll check in with favorite characters embarking on new adventures. Or, if I may, I'd love you to meet some fascinating fictional men and women who populate several classic yet addictive literary series. Let's get this party started as we turn to page one of the book report. We love her because she's smart, resourceful, and never hesitates to get right into the middle of the action. V.I. Warshawski returns in Critical Mass, book 16 in the popular series by Sarah Paretsky. V.I.'s closest friend in Chicago is the Viennese-born doctor, Lottie Herschel, who tragically lost most of her family in the Holocaust. Lottie had escaped to London in 1939 on the Kinder transport with her friend Kitty. When Kitty's daughter finds her life is in danger, she calls Lottie, who in turn summons V.I. The daughter's troubles turn out to be just the tip of the iceberg of lies, secrets, and silence, with links back to the competition among America, Germany, Japan, and England in the race to develop the first atomic bomb. The secrets are old, but the people who continue to guard them will not let go without a fight. Susan Erickson narrates.
The ward head took us to Judy Binder's room. She was attached to machines that monitored her fast-beating heart, administered fluids, checked her breathing. Her eyes were shut, but I didn't think she was asleep. Her cloud of gray streaked curls moved on the pillow as she twitched and groaned. Her face was red and puffy, her lips badly swollen. "Is she allergic to something in her medications?" I asked. Lottie and the ward head exchanged sour looks. "Opiate withdrawal," the ward head said. "She's got a very long rehabilitation in front of her. She isn't going to make a good recovery from the bullet wound if she doesn't take drug rehab seriously. Once we get her physically stable here, she's got to go into a good residential program." Lottie went up to the bedside and put two fingers on Judy's pulse. I could see the raw welts on Judy's arms where she'd been clawing herself. Her eyes fluttered open at Lottie's touch.
"Dr. Lottie, I knew I could count on you. I'm in terrible pain. I need morphine or oxy. Vicodin will do if the dose is strong enough. I can't sleep. My gut is on fire. Get me back my morphine pump."
Lottie ignored her demand. "This is V.I. Warshawski, Judy. She saved your life." Judy barely looked at me.
"Thanks, I guess, for saving me for this torture chamber. Dr. Lottie, I need my morphine. I need it now. You can't come here and not help me."
"I'm not your doctor here, Judy. I'm just a visitor. Miss Warshawski needs to ask you
that she told you to say no, didn't she?"
Judy's voice rose. I was taken aback briefly, thinking she meant me, but then realized she was looking past us to the ward head.
"She's one of those women from Belsen, isn't she? Dressed up in white, pretending to be a nurse, but she's really a Nazi and a torturer. You know, you're a Holocaust survivor. Don't side with her. Get her fired. You're a surgeon. They'll do what you say. Fire a f***ing mean and get me my pump."
"Ms. Binder," I said, "I'm sorry to intrude when you're in pain and when you're grieving."
"Damn straight I'm in pain. And grief, too."
"Because of your mother?" I asked.
"Anyone with a mother like that would grieve over it," she snarled.
"You don't remember seeing her get shot? I'm afraid she wasn't as fortunate as you. She died of her wounds."
Batty Kitty has gone to God. I'm sure he'll be thrilled. And her real father, he'll be ecstatic when she shows up. Who the f*** are you, and why can't you mind your own business? I wanted to yank the IV lines out of her and throttle her, but I kept my voice even. Duck and cover. The night you were shot, you said that duck and cover worked the best, even though she never believed in it. Was that your mother who never believed in it? I'm in pain! Judy screamed. I'm in pain, and you want to interrogate me. You're not a cop. I don't have to tell you anything. She thrashed in her restraints so violently that she knocked the oxygen tube from her nose. Of course you don't, I said. You were very smart to get under your son's bed like that. Duck and cover saved your life. Who told you it was a bad idea? For a moment, Judy stopped tugging at her restraints. I couldn't read the expression in her eyes. The pupils were so dilated. But when she spoke, her voice was soft and dull.
We've just heard Critical Mass by Sarah Paretsky. Patricia Cornwell sold her first novel, Postmortem, while working as a computer analyst at the office of the chief medical examiner in Richmond, Virginia. Postmortem would go on to win numerous prizes, including the Edgar, Creasy, Anthony, and McCavity Awards. To date, Cornwell's books have sold 100 million copies, included among them 26 New York Times bestsellers. Though Patricia now lives in Boston, she was born in Miami and attended Davidson College, earning a degree in English. In 1979, she began working at the Charlotte Observer, ultimately covering the police beat. Patricia went on to the job with the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of Virginia, and it was during this time she worked on her novel Postmortem. Today we'll speak with Patricia about her latest book, Dust. Welcome, Patricia. It's a thrill to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's great to be with you.
Why the title Dust?
Well, dust refers to something both literally and also it's a philosophical word that I think you'll recognize in certain areas of the book when Scarpetta's thinking about, you know, life beginning and ending and dust to dust and just reality and what she thinks about on a more spiritual level. We don't usually explore that with her, but we do in this one. But it also literally refers to when she responds to the first crime scene in dust, and she arrives at this athletic field at MIT, and she sees this body wrapped up in a peculiar white cloth. And the person, she can't see at first any reason why this person's dead. You don't see blood, you don't see anything. She looks very pristine, almost as if she's asleep. And then she takes it in the course of doing her usual external exam at the crime scene. She pulls out an ultraviolet light. It's a forensic light, like a black light that some people are familiar with, to see if there's anything unusual, like fibers or other types of trace evidence that fluoresce. And the reason these people do that is that sometimes there are things that show up with a light that you don't see with a naked eye, and you want to make sure you collect it right then and there so it doesn't get lost. So when she turns on this little ultraviolet flashlight, the body just becomes this electrical display of all this sparkling residue. It looks like fairy dust. It's red, green, and blue, and it's everywhere. It covers the cloth. It's in the person's hair. It's on her feet. It's all over. And Scarpetta, this is really bizarre. She's never seen anything quite like this. And we come to find out that whatever this residue is, and she does have it analyzed in the labs, it's connected to several other cases that, ironically, her FBI profiler husband has been working in the Washington, D.C. area. And so this residue, is, of course, is going to become important into figuring out where these people have been and who the killer is and what he was doing and what part of his modus operandi is. So it's quite a romp with a lot of really interesting forensics in it, a lot of very detailed crime scene investigation, and a lot of philosophizing also about the types of crimes that are being committed today and how different they are from what she used to see in the early days.
Right, which is a very good segue to what you write about in the book as spectacle killings. Talk about that.
Well, this is a new criminalistic category that Benton has come up with to define the type of killer who, whether it is a serial killer who does things to get to shock people and get their attention, or the more obvious example, someone who goes in and shoots up a school full of small children, or shoots up a movie theater or a shopping mall or an airport. These are people, in Benton's mind, he puts in a category of people who create a spectacle in the violence that they choose to perpetrate. And a lot of it has to do with these voids of people who have nothing, but they're loveless and full of hate and resentment, and they want to create as much attention as they can. It's like a suicide bomber. And the problem is, how do you predict this, and you can't stop somebody who's already killed himself or been shot by the police during such a rampage. But what about the next one? How do you envision this invisible person that's like a bomb ready to go off somewhere? It's a new enemy that has created terror in public places. And that's the type of person that Scarpetta's in pursuit of in Dust. It's not someone who's going to get a gun and go shooting up a public place and killing people that way, but he's doing things to get attention. And he's driven by very dark and peculiar compulsions in addition to that.
And do you believe the media has exacerbated this problem and increased the frequency?
I'm not going to blame that on the media. I think that it's inevitable with the exposure that everything gets these days, that somebody can instantly have his or her name all over the universe because of something horrible that they do. And I don't think, there's no way you're going to stop people from reporting on it, and they should report on it. I think what I wish, I would prefer two things. I wish that we would not play the video footage of these people actually killing people in places where there's security cameras, because I feel that for the disturbed person who might be vulnerable to entertaining the same fantasies, you're putting an idea in their mind, they could almost envision themselves with the gun doing that. I don't know why we need to see that. The second thing is, I wish the White House would stop responding to these crimes. It's one thing to give comfort to the families and the victims after the fact. I think that's a great thing for our leaders to do. But to immediately go to the White House for a statement when a shooting is still in the process of going on and being investigated also feeds into the delusions of yet another disturbed person that he or she can get the attention of the President of the United States if he does some, you know, if this person does something bad enough. I think we should be careful how much we make it desirable for the wrong people to follow suit and do something like Sandy Hook or Aurora or the Los Angeles airport.
I see. We're speaking with Patricia Cornwell on The Book Report. I'm going to change tacks for a moment. I wanted to ask you, because I love him, what is it about Marino that makes all of us love him? And how has Kay and Marino's relationship evolved?
Well, it's evolved. It's been on a roller coaster. They started out not getting along way back in the days of Postmortem, and then they became like Mutt and Jeff. But he was her constant sidekick, and then they became very estranged for a while as Marino began to realize that Scarpetta was just never going to have a romantic relationship with him, and I think he sort of has accepted that now, but he's still a little bit, he'll always be a little sweet on her. And she loves him too, but in a very different way. And so he's a great character, and she really needs him around. He's a great foil. He's a very much a contrast to her. She's so pristine and pretty much proper, does things the right way, and is in a very, very rare that Scarpetta really lets loose on a profanity. Just spewing profanity or anything like that. And Marino's just the opposite. He's got no off switch. He's wide open. And I think that's what we like about him, because Marino says exactly what he thinks. He doesn't care if it's politically correct. He just says it like it is.
Yeah. And do you think Lucy might ever have a book of her own? She is a great character.
Well, you know, I have been asked that many times, would I ever do a spinoff series with Lucy as the main character? I should never say never. Right now, that's not in my plan, because Scarpetta keeps me fully engaged, and I think I'd rather be in Scarpetta's mind than Lucy's mind. Lucy's mind is a rather scary place, because she's one of the reasons that she's such a brave and brazen and just fearless character is also because she's wired a little differently. And she's a, you know, if I were to walk into a cocktail party and Scarpetta were sitting on an empty couch and Lucy was sitting on another empty couch, I'd go sit next to Scarpetta. I think I'd be a little scared of Lucy.
I might head for Lucy. But anyway, now I understand you have a new TV project. Tell us about that.
Well, speaking of Lucy, this is not Lucy, but it's another very courageous, rather brazen young female. She's a police investigator. Her name is Greta Stone. She's a brand new character I've come up with. And we're right now, ABC has in development the pilot that we're doing for Greta Stone, the show. And we're very hopeful it's going to spin off into a dramatic series on ABC. So we're working really hard on Greta, even as we speak. And I think people are going to love her. She's very, very smart. She's technologically very savvy. And she has a very decided gift in investigating crimes, in addition to having a very unusual background. So I think that people are going to love spending time with Greta.
And when is Scarpetta coming to the big screen, and who do you wish would play her?
Well, right now we are still in script development. Fox 2000 is the studio, and we're hoping that we're going to be going into production by next fall on the first Scarpetta movie. Who would play Scarpetta? You know, it's people ask me this, and I've been asked it for 20-something years, and of course the name has changed over time, and right now I think that fortunately there's a number of really talented actresses out there that could play this role and make us believe it.
Well, are you already working on another book?
I am. I'm just getting started.
And, of course, it will be Scarpetta again.
It will be.
Okay. Patricia, I love Dust. It's compelling from page one to the very end. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Dust, Book 21 in the Kay Scarpetta series. Kate Redding performs the title.
The bar is located near MIT and caters to artists, physicists, and computer wizards like Lucy. Now and then, she and her partner Janet take me there for Sunday brunch. I'm familiar with the place. Is all I offer this man who has abandoned me, and I know I'm better off. If only it felt like it.
Apparently, Gail Shipton was there late yesterday afternoon with a girlfriend who claims that at around 5:30, Gail's phone rang. She went outside so she could hear better and never came back. You shouldn't have gone to Connecticut alone. At least I could have driven you, Marino says. And he's not going to ask how I'm doing after what he's caused by walking off the job so he could start over. He's a cop again. He sounds happy. The hell with how I feel about the way he did it. All he wants to know about is Connecticut. It's what everyone wants to know about, and I didn't give a single interview, and it's not the sort of thing to talk about. I wish to hell he hadn't brought it up. It's like something hideous I'd filed in a back drawer, and now it's in front of me again. The friend didn't think it was unusual or reason for concern that this person she was with went out to talk on the phone and never came back. I'm on autopilot, able to do my job while I try not to care about Marino anymore.
All I know is when Gail quit answering her phone or texts, the girlfriend got worried something bad happened.
Already he's on a first-name basis with this missing woman who may be dead. Already they've bonded. He's sunk his hooks into the case, and he's not about to let go.
Then when it got to be midnight and still no word, she started trying to find her, he says. The friend's name is Haley Swanson.
What else do you know about Haley Swanson, and what do you mean by girlfriend?
It was a very preliminary call.
What he's really saying is he doesn't know much at all, because what Haley Swanson reported likely wasn't taken very seriously at the time. Does it bother you that she wasn't worried earlier? I ask. If Gail was last seen at 5:30, some 6 or 7 hours passed before her girlfriend called the police.
You know how the students are around here. Drinking, they go off with someone. They don't keep track or notice.
Was Gail the type to go off with someone?
I got a lot of questions to ask if it turns out the way I suspect it will.
It sounds like we don't know a whole hell of a lot.
Even as I say it, I know I shouldn't. I didn't talk to Haley Swanson very long. He's starting to sound defensive. We don't officially take missing person reports by phone.
And how is it you talk to her?
First, she called 911 and was told to come to the department and fill out a report. And that's standard. You come in and do it in person.
He's gotten loud enough that I have to turn the volume down on my phone.
Then she calls back a little later and asks for me by name. I talked to her for a few minutes, but didn't take her all that seriously. If she was so worried, come fill out the report ASAP. We're open 24/7.
Marino's been with the Cambridge police but a few weeks, and it strikes me as almost unbelievable that a stranger would request him by name. Instantly, I'm suspicious of Haley Swanson, but it won't do any good to say it. Marino's not going to listen if he thinks I'm trying to tell him how to do his job.
Did she sound upset? I ask.
A lot of people sound upset when they call the police, but it doesn't mean what they're saying is true. 99 times out of 100, missing students aren't missing. These types of calls aren't exactly uncommon around here.
Do we have an address for Gail Shipton?
Those really nice condos near the Charles Hotel.
He gives me the details and I write them down.
Very expensive real estate.
I envision gracious brick buildings close to the Kennedy School of Government and the Charles River, not far from my headquarters, as a matter of fact.
Probably her family's paying the bills. The usual around here in Ivy Leagueville.
We've just heard Dust by Patricia Cornwell.
Edgar Award-winning author Lisa Scottoline revolutionized crime fiction when she introduced her all-female law firm of Rosato & Associates. Now, Betty Rosato, Mary D'Annunzio, Judy Carrier, and Anne Murphy are back with all cylinders firing in Accused, book 14 in the series. Mary D'Annunzio has just been promoted to partner. She's about to take on an extremely unusual case brought to the firm by a 13-year-old genius. Allegra Gardner's sister Fiona was murdered 6 years ago. It had seemed like an open and shut case. The accused, Lonnie Stahl, was seen fleeing the scene, his blood on Fiona and her blood on him. Most damningly, Lonnie had pleaded guilty. But Allegra believes Lonnie is innocent. The Gardner family is one of the most powerful in the country, and Allegra's parents don't want to reopen the case. But Rosato and Associates can never resist an underdog. Was justice served all those years ago? January Lavoie narrates.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Mary asked Judy as they walked through the prison parking lot to their car.
What?
Judy looked over. Call me crazy, but I don't think he did it. I believe him. Judy fell into step beside her, nodding.
I agree with you. I don't think he did it either.
It's ironic, right? There's a record full of evidence against him. Like you say, he didn't have a chance on appeal. Why do you think he's innocent?
Just by what he said and the way he said it. He gave a completely plausible explanation for how Fiona could have been murdered. If he hadn't gotten so flustered on the stand and he had a better lawyer, he would have had an excellent chance of raising reasonable doubt.
That's why I think it. He's either the best liar on earth, or he's really telling the truth. Or we're projecting wildly and being insanely naive.
There's also the facts of record, not just us being naive.
Judy shook her head, musing as they walked in the same stride.
He didn't take the plea deal initially. That intrigues me. Also, he has no criminal record, and lastly, he testified in his own defense. You can watch Law and Order and know that's suicide, especially if you're guilty.
Good point, Mary said, as they reached the car and she chirped it unlocked.
What a difference a day makes.
What do you mean?
Yesterday, I believed in our client, but not Stahl. Now, I believe in Stahl, but not our client.
I still believe in both. Mary got into the car. So did Judy, and they closed the doors behind them. Will you read me those letters he gave us while I drive? If you promise not to drive off the road in despair. Go, girl. Mary started the engine. They both put on their shoulder harnesses, and Judy dug into the manila envelope, taking out the packet of letters and opening the second one. You want me to read to you? It's all on one line. Judy cleared her throat. Dear Mr. Stahl, I hope you are doing well. I know you are innocent and you will be free soon. Your friend, Allegra Gardner. Doesn't that sound like the first letter? Mary steered out of the parking lot and down the long road to Route 29. Yes. Let me see the third one. Lonnie was nice enough to put them in chronological order. Judy put the second letter away and opened up the third one, while Mary looked over nervously, seeing that it was only one line. Please tell me it doesn't say the same exact thing. It says the exact same thing, which would be the obsessive part. Oh, no. Mary bit her lip, hitting the gas in light traffic on the two-lane road. I can't wait to read the other ones and try to understand what was going on with her. What's the next one say? Let's see. Judy opened the fourth letter while Mary held her breath. Mare, remember in The Shining when Jack Nicholson writes, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull, dull boy over and over and over again?" Yes, Mary answered, dismayed. Well, it's like that, only less entertaining. Mary groaned, hitting the gas and heading for their next appointment. An hour later, Mary and Judy were sitting across the neat desk of Bob Brandt, who turned out to be an up-and-coming sports agent and lawyer. He was African-American, 6'3" and powerfully built, a former running back at Temple, whose broad shoulders strained against the seams of his tailored gray suit with a sharp tie of melon silk. His jovial air belied his size, and his brown eyes were deep-set, earnest, and even playful under a prominent forehead. He wore his hair natural, cut medium short, and he had a close-cropped beard. He must have recently turned 30 years old because there was an array of birthday cards open on a cherry wood credenza, next to framed family photographs of a pretty wife and two adorable little boys. Mary introduced herself and Judy, then got to the point. We've just come from Greaterford, where we met with Lonnie Stahl. We know you represented him in the Fiona Gardner murder case about 6 years ago, and we need to just ask you a few questions.
We've just heard Accused by Lisa Scottoline. On Manhattan's Upper East Side, a woman lies dead at the bottom of a brownstone's basement steps, stripped of all her valuables. Most cops might call it a mugging gone wrong, but Lieutenant Eve Dallas knows better. The scene is set for suspense in Calculated in Death, Book 36 of J.D. Robb's In Death series. A prosperous accountant and a beloved wife and mother, Marta Dickinson doesn't seem the type to be on anyone's hit list. But when Eve and her partner Peabody find blood inside the brownstone, she knows Marta's murder is the work of a trained killer, yet one who is not savvy enough to remove all the evidence. Eve learns that on the day of her murder, Marta had been assigned to work on 3 audits. Was she murdered to cover up a fraud? Eve is good at catching criminals, not crunching numbers. Luckily, she has her husband Rourke to figure out which companies in Marta's files could be suspect. When someone steals the files from Marta's office, Eve must immerse herself in the world of big business to figure out who has enough skin in the game to hire a hit on an innocent woman. And as the killer's violent streak starts to escalate, Eve knows she has to draw him out, even if it means using herself as bait. Susan Erickson narrates.
A killer wind hurled bitter November air. Toothy little knives to gnaw at the bones. She'd forgotten her gloves, but that was just as well, as she'd have ruined yet another overpriced pair once she'd sealed up. For now, Lieutenant Eve Dallas stuck her frozen hands in the warm pockets of her coat and looked down at death. The woman lay at the bottom of the short stairway, leading down to what appeared to be a lower-level apartment. From the angle of the head, Eve didn't need the medical examiner to tell her the neck was broken. Eve judged her as middle 40s. Not wearing a coat, Eve mused, though the vicious wind wouldn't trouble her now. Dressed for business, suit jacket, turtleneck, pants, good boots with low heels. Probably fashionable, but Eve would leave that call to her partner when Detective Peabody arrived on scene. No jewelry, at least not visible, not even a wrist unit. No handbag, no briefcase or file bag. No litter, no graffiti in the stairwell. Nothing but the body slumped against the wall. At length, she turned to the uniformed officer who'd responded to the 911. What's the story? The call came in at 2:12. My partner and I were only two blocks away, hitting a 24/7. We arrived at 2:14. The owner of the unit, Bradley Whitestone, and an Alva Mooney were on the sidewalk. Whitestone stated they hadn't entered the unit, which is being rehabbed, and is unoccupied. They found the body when he brought Mooney to see the apartment. At 2 in the morning. Yes, sir. They stated they'd been out this evening. Dinner, then a bar. They'd had a few, Lieutenant. Okay. My partner has them in the car. I'll talk to them later. We determined the victim was deceased. No ID on her, no bag, no jewelry, no coat. Pretty clear her neck's broken. Visually, there's some other marks on her. Bruised cheek, split lip. Looks like a mugging gone south. But the uniform flushed slightly. It doesn't feel like it. Interested, Eve gave a go-ahead nod. Because? It sure wasn't a snatch and run, figuring the coat. That takes a little time. And if she fell or got pushed down the stairs, why is she over against the side there instead of at the bottom of the steps? Out of sight from the sidewalk. It feels more like a dump. Sir, are you angling for a slot in homicide, Officer Turney? No disrespect intended, Lieutenant. None taken. She could have taken a bad fall down the steps, landed wrong, broke her neck. Mugger goes down after her, hauls her over out of sight, takes the coat and the rest. Yes, sir. It doesn't feel like it. But we need more than how it feels. Stand by, officer. Detective Peabody's en route. As she spoke, Eve opened her field kit, took out her sealant. She coated her hands, her boots, as she surveyed the area. This sector of New York's East Side held quiet, at least at this hour. Most apartment windows and storefronts were dark, businesses closed, even the bars. There would be some after-hours establishments still rolling, but not close enough for witnesses. They'd do a canvas, but odds were slim someone would pop out who'd seen what happened here. Add in the bitter cold, as 2060 seemed determined to go out clinging with its icy fingers, most people would be tucked up inside, in the warm.
That was Calculated in Death by J.D. Robb. Beloved for his imagination, satire, and sheer silliness, Jasper Ford delighted readers with his Thursday Next series. Since the no-nonsense literary detective from Swindon made her debut, literature has never quite been the same. In First Among Sequels, it's been 14 years since Thursday pegged out at the 1988 Superhoop, and Friday is now a difficult 16-year-old. However, Thursday's got bigger problems. Sherlock Holmes has been killed at the Rhinebeck Falls, and his series is stopped in its tracks. And before this can be corrected, Miss Marple dies suddenly in a car accident, bringing her series to a close.
When Thursday receives a death threat, clearly intended for her written self, she realizes what's going on. There is a serial killer on the loose in the book world. And that's not all. The Goliath Corporation is trying to deregulate book travel. Packed with wordplay, bizarrely entertaining subplots, and old-fashioned suspense, Thursday's Return is a literary event of note for fantasy and detective lovers. Emily Gray performs the book.
Only a blunder of staggering proportions would remove the surplus, and the nature of this mind-numbing act of idiocy was a matter of considerable media speculation.
"It says here," he said, getting into full rant mode by adjusting his glasses and tapping at the newspaper with his index finger, "that even the government is having to admit that the stupidity surplus is a far, far bigger problem than they had first imagined."
I held the striped dodo cozy I was knitting for Pickwick against her pink and blotchy body to check the size, and she puffed herself up to look more alluring, but to no avail. She then made an indignant plocking noise, which was the only sound she ever uttered. "Do you think I should knit her a party one as well? You know, black, off the shoulder, with sparkly bits in it."
"But," Landon went on in a lather of outrage, "the Prime Minister has poured scorn on Traffic Cone's suggestion to offload our unwanted stupidity to third world nations, who would be only too happy to have it in exchange for several sacks of cash and a Mercedes or two."
"He's right," I replied with a sigh. "Idiocy offsets our... stupidity is our own problem and has to be dealt with on an individual stupidity footprint basis, and landfill certainly doesn't work." I was thinking of the debacle in Cornwall, where 20,000 tons of half-wittedness was buried in the 60s, only to percolate to the surface 2 decades later, when the residents started to do inexplicably dumb things, such as using an electric mixer in the bath and parting their hair in the centre.
"What if," Landon continued thoughtfully, "the 30 million or so inhabitants of the British archipelago were to all simultaneously fall for one of those email, tell us all your bank details, phishing scams, or, I don't know, fall down a manhole or something?"
"They tried the mass walking into lamppost experiment in France to see if they could alleviate la dette idiote," I pointed out, "but the seriousness under which the plan was undertaken made it de facto sensible, and all that was damaged was the proud Gallic forehead." Landon took a sip of coffee, unfolded the paper, and scanned the rest of the front page before remarking absently,
"I took up your idea and sent my publisher a few outlines for self-help books last week."
"Who do they think you should be helping?"
"Well, me. And them, I suppose. Isn't that how it's meant to work? It looks really easy. How about this for a title? Men are from Earth. Women are from Earth. Just deal with it."
He looked at me and smiled, and I smiled back. I didn't love him just because he had a nice knee, was tall and made me laugh, but because we were two parts of one, and neither of us could imagine life without the other. I wish I had a better way to describe it, but I'm not a poet. Privately, he was a husband and father to our 3 mostly wonderful kids, but professionally, he was a writer. Unfortunately, despite winning the 1988 Armitage Shanks Fiction Award for Bad Sofa, a string of flops had left the relationship with his publisher a bit strained. So strained, in fact, that he was reduced to penning point-of-sale non-fiction classics such as The Little Book of Cute Pets That You Really Like to Hug and The Darndest Things Kids Say. When he wasn't working on these, he was looking after our children and attempting to rekindle his career with a seriously good blockbuster, his magnum opus. It wasn't easy, but it was what he loved, and I loved him, so we lived off my salary, which was about the size of Pickwick's brain. Not that big, and unlikely to become so.
"This is for you," said Landon,
pushing a small parcel wrapped in pink paper across the table. "Sweetheart," I said, really annoyed and really pleased all at the same time. I don't do birthdays.
I know, he said, without looking up. So you'll just have to humour me.
I unwrapped the package to find a small silver locket and chain. I'm not a jewellery person, but I am a Landon person. So held my hair out of the way while he fastened the clasp, then thanked him and gave him a kiss, which he returned.
That was First Among Sequels by Jasper Ford. Ah, mateys, this one's a classic. I just couldn't resist. The 13-gun salute is number 13 in Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin series. Consider this a worthy gift for any would-be swashbuckler on your list, or anyone who's ever loved Captain Jack Aubrey. Remember the movie Master and Commander with Russell Crowe? In this adventure, Captain Jack and Stephen Maturin set sail aboard the Diane for the South China Sea, shepherding a diplomatic mission to prevent links between Bonaparte and the Malay princes. If their mission fails, English merchant shipping in the area will be threatened. At the barbaric court of Pulo Prabang, the stage is set for a duel of intelligence agents, pitting the savage cunning of Stephen Maturin against the French envoys already entrenched in the Sultan's favor. Audiobook lovers of this series have their pick of fantastic narrators, Patrick Tull or Simon Vance. It's a tough choice, but the book report opts here for the Tull version.
There's a great deal to be said for porcupines, Heaven. Solomon had 1,000, and Solomon knew what o'clock it was, I believe. You'll certainly see her again. But the surprise herself was anomalous, too. Although she looked so very like a king's ship, she was, in fact, only a letter of marque, a private man-of-war licensed to cruise upon the enemy. Yet she was no ordinary letter of marque, either, since government was paying her expenses to go to the South Seas, there to harry the French and American whalers and fur traders, and any enemy warship that might be within her capacity. This would normally have brought her much nearer the status of one of His Majesty's hired vessels, particularly as her people were exempted from impressment. But it so happened that the administration's real aim was to enable Dr. Maturin to look into the possibility of independent states arising in Chile and Peru, of their being helped to arise, thus weakening the Spanish Empire. Since Spain was at this time England's ally, the aim couldn't possibly be avowed, nor the payments, nor indeed anything to do with the whole potentially embarrassing affair. This, however, didn't worry the surprises to the least degree. The hands knew that they had their precious exemption, and that they had succeeded in remaining on the books, the highly selective books, of the most extraordinarily successful privateer afloat, one whose recent list of prizes had enabled even the humblest seamen she carried to play ducks and drakes with gold pieces if they chose. Several of them, and several of their shipmates, had so chosen throughout the unexpectedly long period of refitting before the South American voyage, and they were now paupers once more, though very cheerful paupers, since what had happened before might very well happen again, was almost certain to happen again, and even a short cruise, let alone one into the South Sea, might bring Captain Aubrey back with so many prizes at his tail that the port of Shelmerston would be choked for the second time. Yet rather more of them, particularly the 2 and 2.5 share hands, had listened to their captain's advice. Captain Aubrey was remarkably good at giving financial advice. He cried up thrift, caution, small returns. The Navy 5% were the very utmost limit of what he would approve. Perpetual vigilance and strict economy. It was known throughout the maritime world that although Lucky Jack Aubrey had quite certainly earned his nickname at sea, making at least 3 fortunes before the last astonishing stroke, he had also been spectacularly unfortunate by land. At certain periods he'd been extravagant, maintaining a racing stable and cutting a figure at Brooks. At others, he'd been credulous, believing in projectors and their schemes. And generally speaking, disaster had attended upon his undertakings. It was, therefore, perfectly clear to an objective eye that no one had less right to give advice. Yet, among seamen, Aubrey's handling of a ship, his behaviour when he brought that ship into action, his list of victories and his list of prizes, outweighed a certain want of practical management, and his words, always very kindly intended, always adapted to the means and the understanding of his hearers, had great influence, rather as Tom Cribbs on a point of foreign politics might have done. And some of the surprises, all of them married men with children, retired from the sea. But none, except a sailmaker's mate who was married to the daughter and sole heiress of a carrier, had retired very far. And the seven new inns or alehouses called the Aubrey Arms, and with those arms, as your three sheep's heads erased proper on their signposts, now scattered about the country, were all within easy reach of the Strand, and, it must be admitted, of the publican's smuggling brothers, uncles, cousins, nephews, and even, God preserve us, grandchildren.
We've just heard The 13-Gun Salute by Patrick O'Brien. Adventure, intrigue, the mystery of the Pharaohs, and the one, the only Amelia Peabody. I've loved Elizabeth Peters' Amelia Peabody series from book one. Delve into one book and you'll be hooked. The Book Report is pleased to present one of the series' favorites, The Serpent on the Crown, book 17. In this adventure, Amelia and her family look forward to delving once more into the age-old mysteries buried in Egypt's ever-shifting sands. But a widow's strange story, an even stranger request, plunge them into a storm of secrets, treachery, and murder. The woman, a well-known author, has come bearing an ill-gotten treasure, a golden likeness of a forgotten king, which she claims is cursed. She insists it has taken the life of her husband, and unless it is returned to the tomb from which it was stolen, more people will die. Amelia and her clan resolve to uncover the secrets of the statue's origins, setting off on a trail that twists and turns in directions they never anticipated. The incomparable Barbara Rosenblatt performs the book.
Nefret, who had been staring fixedly at Mrs. Petherick, said, "Forgive me, but your face is familiar. Aren't you Magda, Countess von Ormond, the novelist?" "Aha," I thought. "That explains the accent. According to her publicity releases, the Countess came from a noble Hungarian family. She had fled that country during the upheaval of the World War." The lady's mouth opened in a wide, pleased smile. "You have read my books. I will be happy to sign the ones you have with you." "I didn't bring any with me," said Nefret, her expression bland as cream. "I saw you several years ago at a literary luncheon in London. At that time, I believe, you weren't married."
"My dear Pringle and I became one only a year before his dreadful death. And now," she continued, "the curse has fallen upon me. Twice I have beheld that grim black figure, and my intuition tells me that the third time will mean my death. Take it, I beg you."
She thrust the box at Ramses. Eyeing it askance, he stepped back. I took it, and was about to lift the lid when Mrs. Petherick let out a ladylike screech.
"Don't open it. I never want to see that evil little face again."
"Am I to understand," I inquired, "that you are passing the curse on to us?"
"But you are experienced in dealing with such things," Mrs. Petherick exclaimed, rolling her black-rimmed eyes. "You can do it safely. You have done it before. I have heard the stories.
The stories to which she referred were lurid newspaper articles, many of them written by our journalist friend, Kevin O'Connell, though in every case the purported curse had been proved false, and the evils attributed to it had been found to be caused by a human criminal. Many readers remembered the sensational theories and ignored the rational explanations. If the woman actually believed we could cancel curses and defeat evil spirits, she had to be acquitted of deliberate malice. The children would soon be joining us, and I did not want their juvenile imaginations stirred up by such nonsense. I was about to suggest to Mrs. Petherick that she tie a stone to the confounded thing and toss it in the Nile when Emerson cleared his throat. His sapphirine eyes were bright, and his handsomely tanned face bore an expression of amiable concern. "Curse it," I thought. "Very well," he said. "You may leave it with us, madam. I will perform. I will take care of the matter." Mrs. Petherick leaned back in her chair, ignoring Emerson's hint. "What are you going to do? Return it to the tomb from which it was stolen?" "That might prove a trifle difficult," Ramses said, with a critical look at his father. "If, as I assume, it was purchased on the antiquities market, there's little hope of tracing the original thief and finding out where he obtained it." said Emerson, giving his son an equally critical look. "You know my methods, Ramses. Rest assured, madam, that you need not give the matter another thought. Good day to you." This dismissal was too direct to ignore. Mrs. Petherick rose to her feet, but made one more attempt to prolong the conversation. "It killed my dog, too," she offered. "My poor little pug. He choked and twitched and was gone. Just like that." Fatima, seeing that we had a guest, had managed to detain the children, but I could hear them expostulating in their high-pitched voices. Emerson heard them, too. He got Mrs. Petherick to the door of the veranda, but not before she had told us where she was staying, and had asked to be informed when the curse had been officially lifted. She added, with an air of complacency quite at variance from her initial distress, "Perhaps I should participate in the ceremony." "That will not be necessary," said Emerson, shoving the lady into her carriage and motioning the driver to proceed. "Really, Emerson," I said, "what ceremony? You made no promise, but your failure to deny her suggestion was a tacit..."
"Well, what else could I have done?" Emerson demanded. "The woman was in considerable distress. Her mind will now be at ease."
We have just heard The Serpent on the Crown by Elizabeth Peters. There are so many new titles out now, just in time for holiday gifting. It was really difficult to choose which to feature. For more ideas, all present perfect for the readers on your list, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.